Welcome to Once Upon a Story, a public health palliative care podcast from La Trobe University.
Hello, my name is Crystal Wallace and I am the Volunteer Services Consultant at Eastern Palliative Care.
And I'm Carly and I'm a PhD researcher at the moment.
Yes, you are, and very close to finishing, which is really exciting. So today's topic, episode 4 in our Once Upon a Story podcast, Carly and I are going to be having a look at the concept of relationships and collaboration and how that works between the various players that are within the biography program at EPC, which is the other shortened name for Eastern Palliative Care. Carly, how about we start and remind our listeners around the philosophy that you were able to identify through your research?
Yeah, sure. So we have mentioned it very briefly before, but to recap, I've written a philosophy that has four parts, and obviously I'll go into each of these parts in a lot more detail, but very generally, the first part is that the Eastern Palliative Care Biography Program has a really strong identity of personhood. So it's very strongly focused on a person-centred approach, and that recognises the people who are entirely involved in the program, not just the patients or the clients, so that personhood is attributed to all the people who are involved. The second part is that there's a recognition of lifelong learning. And again, this varies between all the different parts, all the different people who are involved in the program. So there's the ability for everybody to learn at whatever stage of life they're in. So that's for the clients. They have an opportunity to do something new as part of this biography program. For the volunteers, they come with a wealth of experience, but there's probably a ton that they also need to learn about how to be involved with this program. For the family who are involved, they might learn new things, and the same for staff as well. And having spoken about all those four different groups, the third part of the philosophy is that the program is run very relationally. It's developed entirely on the ability to develop relationship with each other. So that is firstly, very prominent, obviously, between the client or the storyteller and the volunteers. But while they might seem to be the central relationship, they're certainly not the only or sort of even the main relationship, because the development of relationship between the staff and the volunteers is just as important. And then there's also the relationships between all the other dynamics. So there's volunteers and staff, volunteers and storytellers, volunteers and carers or family members, and then all the other versions of staff and clients and all those sorts of things. So that those dynamics of relationship are really important. And finally, that the program is creative. And this was the one that I found really hard to work out, even though now it seems really, really obvious. And I found it difficult because it's not anything that really is explicitly talked about. No one really came to me and said, this is a really creative program, this is what we do in these creative elements. So there's certain ways that this is discussed by the volunteers, because obviously there's a creative element in how they put together the biographies. But the creativity of the program extends beyond perhaps those individual aspects in the way that the whole program operates is sort of a creative structure. And one of the things that we will get to talking about is that I use a theatre metaphor to try and explain that creative dynamic that is not simply an aspect of the program. It is the program. I don't know. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I was so excited when you actually brought me that concept, because it made a lot of sense in my world and the way I think. And so I'm looking forward to us exploring that a bit more later on. I guess my first question at the moment, though, is why was it important to articulate a philosophy? Like, how does that fit with the research?
Yeah, sure. And again, that was a little bit of a surprise for me as well, because it wasn't necessarily what I set out to do. The research approach was quite exploratory and a little bit broad to begin with. It was just going in there to listen to participants who volunteered for the research and to discover how they experienced the program. And the research developed from that. So there, obviously there were research questions that I had, but they were refined as we went along. And one of those was, why does the program operate the way that it does? Or how does the program operate the way that it does? And I guess I had that question in the back of my head. That was vaguely the question, but how to exactly frame that question is something that developed as I went along. And it really came about because I was going to go to a conference, and I was going to be talking about sort of the ethics of storytelling. And I knew that I had a number of examples that I could talk about this. And so I started writing and putting it all together, and then realized that I was doing sort of two separate things. I was giving these separate examples of how the program operates and individual stories that people have told me or that I'd heard about perhaps difficult things that had happened that had influenced the development of the program. But while I was doing that, I was also trying to explain how all of those stories fit together, the good and the bad story. So there's not really very many bad stories, but those more positive and negative stories, how they all came together. And I was trying to explain how that all fit. And I realized I was writing the philosophy of the program, and that it became a way of explaining sort of the best version of the biography program. I understand that there's a lot of, you know, it's a dynamic program.
Yes, yeah.
And so perhaps things don't always go the way that you expect. There are always things that need to be in development. I know that it's a very fluid program. Things, they might operate one way, but that doesn't mean that they can't do something different. And, yeah, so I realized that I was writing this philosophical sort of foundational work of how the program fits together the way that it does. So it was a way of, encompassing the variety of experiences, of recognizing its adaptability. I know adaptability isn't one of the key points, but it's sort of inherent within quite a few of them. The personhood, obviously adaptability to each person, and particularly the creative element, that's a huge adaptability. And it explained the individual approach as well, so that personhood and that person-centered approach was taken.
What I really loved too about the fact that you drew the philosophy out is that over the years that we've trained many organisations from around Australia and even overseas around how to develop their own volunteer biography program. And it's been interesting to watch some have really gone on and flourished and others haven't at all. And to sort of ponder that question, what's going on there? Why are some working really well and building and growing and others are not? And I think now that we've got a really good grounded academic basis to stand on around the philosophy, that sort of articulates that. So that's going to really help us in training other organisations, because we can pass those thinking kind of nebulous concepts we were using, but we can now articulate what they are. Do you want to go into a little bit of the theatre metaphor and how that looks and what that means?
Sure. I'll just preface my explanation by saying that I understand that theatre companies aren't all the same, although there is a similar way that they operate. And that's the same palliative care organisation. So there's a lot of wiggle room within both of these, but it's just a way of explaining how the creative element, that it is creative. It does just not have creative elements within the biography program. So the theatre metaphor is a sort of backwards theatre. So EPC begin with a live performance and move towards a written script, whereas normally a theatre company begin with written script, move towards live performance. So it is backwards in that way, but there are other similar elements within that. So the volunteer listens to the storyteller in their storytelling of their life, and that is the live performance element. And from that, they then work towards that written script as the final product. And the interesting thing about that final product is, even though it's a written script or story, it is also something that becomes live in that other people can then read it as well. So there is still an interactive element of that final performance. So the volunteers I've described as co-actors. So they're in that moment with the storyteller. Sort of like our dynamic here, that we're both here together working off each other, and there's an element of that for the storyteller and the volunteer. So the storyteller is sort of the main actor, The volunteer is the co-actor, but I've also described them, they have a very mixed role, the volunteers, as an audience member, because obviously they're witnessing that storytelling, but also a dramaturg, which perhaps might not be as a familiar description, but it's a bit of a nebulous role within the theatre world as well. But they're there to help the theatre production be the best that it can be.
Yeah.
So a dramaturg, that they might help with the script writing, they might help with the performance elements, or they might have all sorts of elements that they help, that they bring in to help that performance be the best that it can be.
And that makes a lot of sense to me, because I think another role for the dramaturg is also to give context for whatever the production is that's going on. And we can see that with our volunteers. You know, they're very, very adaptable. So number one, as audience members and co-actors, they really do bounce off the storyteller, the other actor. But the dramaturg function comes in as they're drawing the story out, and they're incredibly perceptive. They'll walk into a home, they'll have a look around. What is this telling me? What more can I glean to make sure we get the full story? There's one lady I'm remembering who had a glioblastoma, which is a brain tumour, and that means that her cognition was not as it used to be. So she was forgetting whole swathes of her own story. And a friend dropped in on one of the biography sessions and said to the biographer, did you know that she was actually a creative person? And all of a sudden, this whole other element came in. Now, that was the biographer acting as dramaturg by sort of sourcing more information around the context of that particular lady.
Yeah, and I think that the reason that I really wanted that term dramaturg, perhaps rather than editor, is or even writer, is because they're not either of those things.
Correct.
They're not there as a writer, obviously. And even the storyteller isn't really a writer in the way that we might think of an author or something like that. It's a bit more flexible than that. But I really wanted to move away from any sort of editing or editor type language. And that's, because they're there to work with the storyteller. And while they have a bit of an editor function within the actual putting together of the story, they're there to facilitate that storytelling and adapt to the storyteller. And I think they do that very well, and it would take quite a bit of skill, I think, to get used to being that adaptable.
That's right. And we ask them to draw out the essence of the person, and that in itself therapeutically reconnects the person back into who they actually are. So they are more than just someone who's got a medical illness. They are creative, they're passionate about social justice, they're, you know, whatever makes them them is kind of why we're trying to draw those concepts back through.
And perhaps I'll connect that back to the philosophy then, in that first part that I mentioned of personhood. And one of the reasons why I very specifically used person-centered care rather than patient-centered care, I understand why you have patient-centered care, but the patient or the client, or in this case the storyteller, they're not necessarily involved in this program as a patient. Even though they might be connected into EPC because they are a patient, their role in this storytelling is as a person who is... the illness is part of who they are and their experience now, but it is not the focus or the totality of who they are. Yeah, so that felt very important to highlight.
Yeah, beautiful.
As well.
Beautiful.
The second element perhaps we'll talk about is the dynamic between the volunteers and the EPC staff. And so the EPC staff operate, and particularly your team, well, I guess I am exclusively in this case talking about your team, the volunteer services team, as the staff who have the most to do with the volunteers and help operate and facilitate the program. So the volunteer services staff operate sort of as a director within this theatre metaphor, not a director as they're there every step of the way telling people what to do, sort of that's not part of the role, but rather as a director who is overseeing a whole lot of little performances that are all going on all at once, and they're there as a sort of extra guide. They're there as someone to help bounce off if there are issues. They're there to oversee that everything is happening as it needs to. They're perhaps also there to provide some boundaries if we need boundaries and to provide extra guidance in that whole dynamic, I guess we could say. So that they're there not as a as a daily director within each of those storytelling roles, but as a sort of an overall director.
Yeah, and that's a really, really fascinating dynamic to have, because when the volunteer, so the dramaturge, co-actor is working with the actor, they are very, very invested in what's going on in that mini performance. They've got to know the storyteller very, very well. They're spending hours and hours of work in drawing this story out and pulling it together. And so then along comes the directors, producers, whatever you want to call them, who have got a broader oversight, who also need to have some say into what's actually happening. Mm-hmm. Now, because we've got regular feedback loops going in where the volunteer is sending us emails after every session that they have with the storyteller, we're very aware of where things are up to, how the story is progressing, and we're very interactive around that. We also work really hard on good relationships with our volunteers. It doesn't always go smoothly, and I think I'm thinking of one example quite a while ago where we had a story that came through. The front cover had borders that were in this bright purple / orange weird concoction, clip artish-esque. And we sat there for a minute going, oh no, what are we going to do? Because we were fairly certain that the client had not requested that. In the end, we just got our big girl courage on and I rang up the biographer and said, listen, by the way, we can't use that front cover, that border. It just, the colours really, really don't work. And he just burst out laughing and said, oh, my wife always tells me I'm terrible with colours. And so he didn't care. But that's also because we had such a good relationship, we could go into that space and say, your creative choices are a little bit questionable at the moment.
And that again highlights the part of the philosophy, the relational element, is that how important that is to develop between you as staff and volunteers and clients to try and work out all those individual elements and not have terrible borders on front covers, things like that. And I guess I didn't actually highlight, so I highlighted one role of the EPC staff as sort of that director role, but there is also another role sort of as producer, which at the moment you sort of hold as the volunteer services coordinator who oversees sort of everything as a producer. And that is a sort of a direct line between EPC, which I'll now say is also I see as sort of the theatre company on large. So, you know, they provide the situation in which the theatre happens and that everything is created. And you work as a producer in that you're working between the expectations of EPC as an organisation and the desires of whatever the biography program needs or has and the individual. So there's an element of working between those two roles that you occupy, but I know other staff may also occupy as well. And so those terms, again, to not define anything, but to give a working element that the biography program fits within, rather than saying this is exactly how you have to do it.
Correct.
And
And I think in our discussions in the past, we've talked about how a producer's role is all around the budget, how big is the doorway? Can we actually get that scenery in the doorway? Yeah. Is there another way that we could, create something? Don't forget, everyone, we're not actually putting on, the arts centre.
Yeah. And maybe I'll say that was my way of describing this, is that we don't think of this as a theatre company that does produce Les Mis.
Correct.
At the Princess
Theatre.
As much as I'd love to do that. That would be fantastic. But this is a community theatre. This is a community theatre that sits right in the community. It produces small, really relationally based productions where the actors probably bring clothes from home to supplement the costume wardrobe, all those sorts of things. And I think one of the examples that I used is it's a theatre company where you go, we can't actually make the set that we would really like to make, but we can make a version of it out of cardboard or whatever we need to, because our audience recognises that we don't need to have the best props, the best costumes, to still put on a performance that's highly relational, very personalised, and really demonstrates the life of the person that the story is talking about.
Yeah, and what I love about that too is that it's highly adaptable.
Yes.
You can, it's very transferable. And we often will say to our biographers in training, we're not writing War and Peace.
Yeah.
We're not going for the next, you know, Nobel Prize in literature. Let's just get away from all of that because we want to keep it focused on the client and be true to who they are. So, yeah, that's a beautiful way to explain it. Now, there's a dynamic that you picked up between the volunteers and the families of the storyteller.
Yeah, so the families operate as... So the volunteer, as I've said, they operate as in multiple roles. They're the co-actor, dramaturg, but also an audience. But the families are also an audience of this story. They occupy varying types of audiences, though. In some dynamics, there might be a family member who is actually present when the storyteller is initially telling their story for whatever reason. There might be any number. But many family may not get to witness any sort of live storytelling or live storytelling, but may become an audience of the final product. And so they get to be a witness of that final story that is written. Some people will have the opportunity to keep on talking about that story with the storyteller, but many may not. They might not get to read that until after the storyteller has died. And so they become this very sort of unique audience in that they get to witness a story that they perhaps know some of, but perhaps learn more about as they witness that story.
Yeah, and that's one of those interesting cases. So just as a theatre company will get feedback from the audience, even potentially as the performance is happening, we do get that interaction going on between the families and the biographer, and it can be varied. So generally feedback is positive, but if we're in the process, sometimes we'll hear back from families going, oh, you know, my husband Bill, he's so confused, he's on so much medication, he's getting the time timeline's all wrong, he's got the dates wrong, and they'll want to change something, or a daughter will somehow get a hold of the transcripts and be really cross because there's not enough about her and the wedding, or something will happen in those spaces. So it's quite a challenge, and usually EPC staff will assist the biographers with the families and just reminding them that why we're doing this, because we want to stay true to the person who's in front of us, the storyteller. It's all about the therapeutic value of reminiscing, whether the facts are true or not in that moment is not important. And one of our really good go-to lines is that we're giving computer copies to the client afterwards, so the families can go and fix up things that they need to if they want to. If we do have a family member who is heavily involved in the storytelling, generally they're quite appropriate, but we will always reference the fact that, you know, Bill and his son Peter were part of this storytelling process.
Sure.
And that's to alert future audience members why they might be picking up a slant that we're not aware of. Hopefully they'll be grateful, because without the son Peter's assistance, we may not have been able to get anything down there at all. But, yeah, that is a interesting dynamic to tiptoe around sometimes.
Yes, and a very unique one that has to be adapted every single time.
Exactly.
Yeah, so there's a really – it's an interesting dynamic in that it's not – well, it could be either, actually. There could be an audience, it's almost audience participation in some ways, but not always.
Correct.
Sometimes it will be and sometimes it won't be. So, yeah, as the philosophy says, it's very personalised, adaptable and relational. Again, why that aspect of relationship was so important to include in the philosophy. There was, pardon me, there was one other thing that I noticed sort of as I came to the end of writing this philosophy and noticing the theatre dynamic. I came across something that's called paradoxical leadership. And so this isn't part of the philosophy, but it's kind of it's either a result of the philosophy or it's an aspect of the philosophy. I almost don't know. It's a very dynamic relationship, but there is this aspect of paradoxical leadership, and I actually want to give a little definition of that, if that's okay, that it paradoxical leadership is leadership that contains what appears to be the paradoxical views of leading with clear goals and instructions while also giving volunteers a sense of autonomy over their work and involving them in the decision-making process. So this description of paradoxical leadership is how I have come to view the volunteer services type of leadership within this very relational dynamic. And I came across that description and just went, that seems like a perfect description of what I see you or the volunteer services team as doing as a result of this research and what I've heard from volunteers. Is that something that was intentional or that you were aware of, or how does that sound to you?
That sounds, by the way, listeners, if you're hearing a little thud there, we have a cat with us. He's keeping us greatly entertained.
Cat Saffron is having the zoomies right now.
He is. I didn't know cats had zoomies.
They do.
You're right. You're spot on. I wouldn't have been able to say what the term was, but sure. As soon as you sent me that definition, the penny dropped. And that is the way we deliberately lead. Part of that is around the belief that if we lean into each other's strengths and if we remain open to each other and have this constant feedback loop going back and forth, we're going to end up with the best program, the best outcome, the clients and carers will be served the best. We're going to flourish. Everyone wants to flourish. Mm-hmm. The clients want to flourish. The volunteers want to flourish. We want them to flourish because we want them to stay as well. You know, mm-hmm. Volunteering, you've got to have something that's feeding your own soul in order to stay and keep going. So we're very much into empowerment and trust with our volunteers. We say to them, you are the leaders, you are on the front line with the client. If you think something needs to happen and we've said something else, we will follow your judgment call on that because we're not there. But we do actually, as staff, get onto the coal face as much as we can because it's very important to us that we keep fresh around what is actually happening with our clients. What does it feel like to be sitting in front of a storyteller and listening? What are our volunteers actually experiencing in that space? And then we can bring that information back. It informs our training. It informs the way we respond to our volunteers. A lot of our volunteers, we use them as trainers, mm-hmm. Not just mentors. And so, yes, there's a strong cyclical nature that's going on around leadership within this program.
Mm. Yeah, when I found it, I was like, that's such a perfect description of, yeah, what is quite an interesting dynamic and potentially quite difficult to develop sometimes between of having that very strong, clear goals. You've got a very strong purpose. There are boundaries that you have to fit within, but also giving the volunteers such a strong sense of autonomy over how they operate within sort of the specifics of the program, which I think from my observation, they all really, really appreciate.
and it's an interesting one when I look at some other programs that I've heard about. And when I see managers, leaders who are threatened by people sitting in front of them, and so what they do is they clamp down further or they put in more policies and processes and rules and, you know, that kind of thing, that's a huge danger sign for any program because that means you're going to start to bottleneck it and the rot will start to develop and wreck your program. Mm. So whether it's a rot of dissatisfaction, people feeling disempowered, feeling undervalued, not seen, and so because we know that, we will never go into that space. We want people to be emerging stronger and greater and better because that's going to serve the whole circular, everyone involved more.
Yeah. And if I can I'll try and perhaps tie all this back together in that what I observed of the volunteers and everyone like that, that The reason I think that this is perhaps so important is because you are actually operating within the community. People are still within their own homes. They're very much the clients. They are both unwell but are also within their lives still. And so the EPC is a community organisation. They're actively working in the community. But the very strong focus of the biography program and the philosophy and everything like that is that the focus is not necessarily on improving health or curing or anything like that. The focus is on wholeness of the people who are involved. And unfortunately, for some people, that might mean that their health does not improve. But they might still be able to achieve a sense of wholeness or holistic health that is beyond that of cure, but about how they live and the choices that they make, and even just the simple remembrance of what they've done in their lives, or the social interaction between them and the storyteller and the volunteers and all those sorts of things, that there's a real focus on wholeness and personhood. Obviously, that's very strongly with the clients and the storytellers, but also the volunteers, everybody who is involved, the focus is on the wholeness and the personhood of everyone as a core function, rather than as something off to the side that you're trying to achieve as well. That the purpose is very much in that wholeness. And I found that pushes a little bit the boundaries of the biopsychosocial spiritual palliative model of care. So very, very briefly, there's obviously very strong biomedical needs for a palliative care organisation. That's very clear, very necessary. But this program really helps push those boundaries beyond that concept of cure or healthcare that is about treatment into a perspective of healthcare that is about wholeness. And I found that was a really important aspect of this program, and it's something that I feel goes beyond perhaps what other programs might try to achieve, that they have a specific goal of achieving, I mean, very worthwhile aspects, but maybe of having specific improving anxiety or depression or all those sorts of things, of which, again, worthy goals and they should be worked for. But perhaps for someone, the goal is to simply write down a couple of pages of memories, or to write a letter that's included, or to, there are a huge variety of other goals as well that are just as relevant within this whole program.
And we're going to explore some of those in our next episode, some of the unexpected things that were achieved through people engaging with the biography program. And we're also going to look at how the research itself took a narrative personalised perspective. So thank you, everyone, for listening to us today, and tune in for episode 5.
Thanks.
This research is supported by a La Trobe University Research Scholarship, funded in part by Eastern Palliative Care Incorporated. It is being carried out in partial fulfilment of a PhD research under the supervision of Dr. Bruce Rumbold, Dr. David Azul, and Dr. Fiona Gardner, and previously Dr. Susan Finesse. The researcher conducting the research is Carly Edgar. You can find out more about Eastern Palliative Care at epc.asn.au. You can find out more about La Trobe at latrobe.edu.au. This has been a La Trobe University podcast, produced in Melbourne, Australia, and on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people, and with thanks to Matt Bourne as our recording engineer.